Hi, this is Joe Van Wee, your host of All Better. I had a few announcements. If you're interested in subscriber content, which we're about to launch, this would be STEP workshops, cognitive behavioral therapy tools, and mindfulness practices that are approachable and can be very useful in reducing anxiety, rumination, and depression. Please send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. And if you like the episodes that you've been hearing very much, please stop by Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and a small review. This helps us stay relevant in the field of content and helping people and their families with substance use disorder. Thank you. Hello, and thanks again for listening to another episode of All Better. I'm your host, Joe Van Wee. Today's guest is Ryan Barba. Ryan is from Delaware, and Ryan is going to tell a story of personal recovery today, of how a career in professional golf was interrupted by an addiction that he could not hide any longer. I'll let him tell that story in his own words, but Ryan is also a patient at Fellowship House, outpatient, an intensive outpatient and partial hospitalization program. That is a program I am a founder of. So that's the disclaimer. Let's meet Ryan Barba. That's the sound effects. Ryan, thanks for coming over today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. This is like my dream.
To be on a podcast?
Yeah. Well, I've told you this. I've always wanted to start my own.
Were you ever a guest on a podcast before?
No. I've always wanted to.
Yeah. But
never happened.
How about, do any of your friends do golf podcasting?
No, I listen to a lot of them though. I kind of wanted to start my own just with like, you know, everyday stuff, you know, including kind of sobriety and stuff like that to kind of throw in there too, but it's kind of everyday life.
Well, let's talk about it. You stay in Scranton for another year, which it's unlikely with the plans you've been making and you're a professional golfer. Yeah. But if you do, take the mic here, take 3 weeks of All Better. You could interview only Delaware people.
Yeah.
That'd be cool. Come on All Better and you could interview Brendan Novak.
Yeah. screw him.
Do you think he would do it?
I think he would. Yeah. I mean, I talked to him about it. You know, I gave him your number and, you know, I was hoping to maybe have him come up. Even my year celebration, whether I'm here or not, I want to celebrate my year up here. Yeah. And I was kind of hoping maybe he would come up and be a part of that too.
Who's Brendan Novak for anyone who's listening?
Brendan is it was funny. I mean, my brother, he's a big skateboarder and, very good. And, he, during his drinking days, he kind of befriended Bam Margera and became really close with him. And, I think from what I understand is, you know, I mean, Novak lived with Bam and my brother would kind of hang out with that whole crowd.
This is like the 2000s, like early 2000s.
No, this was, probably 2012 to 2015-ish around there.
Oh, okay, sure.
Around there, but you know, he kind of got caught up in that crowd and then, you know, I lived with my mom and so did he. We all lived together and then Novak, decided to move in with us and he was still in active use then. And, it was just kind of you picture the Jackass TV show. That's kind of what I had to live through. And I was kind of like their puppet. In a way,
yeah.
You know, where I would get peed on every night, you know, I would get dead animals thrown in, you know, and I would sleep on the couch. I didn't have my own room. So, you know, they would be coming home at 5 a.m. in the morning and that's when they would kind of.
So you didn't have to like leave home to be hazed every night. Like every evening you came home to a hazing or a prank that.
Yeah. Somewhere out
there, you know, animals.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Well, let's start from the beginning. Right. Where are you from? And we're going to get to the point of how you ended up in Scranton. And for a disclaimer, Ryan, has been, the first patient and resident of my outpatient and IOP. So I wanted to put that out there so it's not cheap marketing, and you could absolutely criticize anything about the house here openly. I'm afraid of nothing. I'll take criticism, we'll change. But I always ask you guys what we could be doing better. But where did you grow up?
Yeah, so I was born in Delaware. I don't remember any of that, but yeah, we moved to, North Carolina, and I spent most of my childhood, in North Carolina, and, it was great. I mean, I couldn't have asked for really a better childhood growing up. And as far as that, you know, my dad got in a promotion and we were going to, move back up to the area, in Pennsylvania. You know, about a half hour south from Philly, called Kennett Square. So we moved, you know, up there, and, you know, even my childhood became, you know, a dream childhood, really. I was a big skateboarder back then too. I didn't really, I was introduced to golf at a very young age, even in North Carolina. You know, I have videos of me whacking a club and things like that. But, the cool thing back then, you know, when I was in middle school was to skateboard, and I kind of wanted to fit in. And, I decided, and I was really good at it. I was, you know, me and my brother, you know, bonded in that, perspective. But, my dad was a member at this golf club, where we lived at. And, you know, I would go out with him every now and again, and I kind of caught the bug. And it was funny because I tried to hide it in a way, because golf was stupid, you know, back in.
Well, to your crew, like to your peers?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it wasn't.
No one knew that I really like golfed. And so in a way I had to kind of like sneak out and, you know.
Yeah. It's funny. Skateboarding and golf, it seemed like they would clash culturally, but they're two hobbies, leisures, or even lifestyles that for most people who start them, skateboarding or golf, they don't ever have to stop doing them. Everyone I knew that skateboarded in middle school, then high school, a good portion of them are now in their 40s. They still friggin' skateboard.
Yeah, I mean, look at Tony Hawk.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy's like, you know, I think he just got surgery too recently, and guy's still skateboarding. You know, it's
amazing.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing. You know, I would have never considered that when we would, hey, skate or die, dude, like all the jocks attacking skateboarders, but, that it's a lifestyle that lasted 4 decades for my friends that mm-hmm. skateboard, well into their 40s, some in their 50s, still skating on mm-hmm. weekends, skate through town, go on a road trip, skate through another town. But golf also commits someone to a lifelong lifestyle too. So how does golf end up winning over skateboard? How does this play out?
I don't know, to be honest. I mean, everyone's always talked about the golf bug, you know, and people who have never golfed and they try it for the first time and they catch that bug. And I think that's what I don't know. I think it was just more of like a really good escape for me, but so was skateboarding in a way too. You know, it was, they're both very like you're outside, you know, you're enjoying the weather. And, but, I don't know. It was just a way for me to escape. Cause I mean, during that time I was kind of going through, my parents were getting divorced at that time too. And me and my father bonded over that a lot. And I became pretty good at it at a young age. And I won the club championship, you know, when I was like 15 or 16, they gave you a parking spot and I got a parking spot. I didn't have my license yet. And, the members weren't too happy about that, but, I would park my bike there cause I live so close. So I would park my bike there, or my dad would park there. And, during that time, I mean, my dad would, he would, you know, we would travel everywhere to play in tournaments and stuff at an age. And those,
what age are you at that?
I would say like 13 to, you know, 17.
Wow.
We traveled, everywhere, you know, Florida, California, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina.
Now was your dad, was he a pro?
No,
he's just a, he's just an avid golfer.
Played his whole life. Really
has likes the lifestyle, can travel, can golf. Without skipping over something, I kind of want to just bore down. Yeah. Just the divorce. How old were you when your parents got divorced?
I would say around 13, around that age.
And it lasts for like, what, like this goes over for 2 years, a year?
It was, I think the divorce was finalized with it, the separation period was, I think, 7 years. It was,
yeah.
It was kind of a nasty one.
That's tough.
Yeah. And, you know, it at that age, you know, I didn't, a lot of my friends' parents were divorced, so I kind of like was going with the flow, you know, and I didn't really think too much of it. But, you know, in a way it took a little bit of a toll on me. But, you know, because, you know, I got to be careful because my mom's probably going to listen to this, but you know, she, you know, when we moved there, she kind of became a pretty avid drinker, and we were kind of known as like the party house, and yeah. My dad had moved out, and you know, it was hard for me to go to bed, you know, when I knew they were out drinking or whatever. And my dad's not an alcoholic by any means, but, my mom kind of became one in a way. And, I think it goes a little bit deeper than that, but you know, but you know, when they wouldn't come home until like 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, and then they would sometimes argue and I would have to, you know, I wouldn't be working off too much sleep, you know, for school the next day, you know, and, but again, I think that was all normal.
Yeah.
Just based off of like, you just have to deal with it, you know?
And when did you, so you're traveling 13 to 17 golf. Is that kind of crisis that can explode a home? That's not uncommon, with your peers. When did you find your first kind of refuge in a drink or a drug, being that you're bonding with your dad, 13 to 17, did your addiction start in that window?
I would say so. I mean, I guess I started drinking, you know, pretty early on, probably in around seventh, eighth grade, not really heavily, but, just kind of, you know, a few beers here and there on family vacations and stuff like that. And once I got to high school, though, you know, I was a freshman. My brother was a senior, and he was pretty popular as a student there. And so I got kind of picked on a lot when I was a freshman. But when he left, I had to kind of maintain that, you know, popularity and continue to throw these parties while, you know, and he would still throw them even after he graduated. You know, I had people coming up to me in hallways that people I didn't even know, like, oh yeah, I hear you having a party this weekend. Like, what? News to me, you know, but yeah, usually every single weekend we would throw a party.
Yeah.
I'd say, yeah.
And how many people would attend this party?
Yeah, it depended. If I threw it, I kind of like to have people that I knew, kind of, you know, a smaller circle. My brother would kind of invite, he knew a lot more people than I did. So he would invite a lot more, but, I would say, I don't know, 10 to 30 people,
yeah.
Sometimes 50, maybe.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, my name is Joe Van Wee. I'm the host of All Better, but I'm also the CEO of Fellowship House. And at Fellowship House, we believe long-term recovery requires a personality change as well as a clinical intervention. These ideas can take several months to achieve. Our philosophy is to provide a safe, therapeutic, and exceedingly active environment for patients to achieve these personality changes and find joy in the fellowship of recovery, which will allow for long-term sobriety. We believe that recovery extends beyond treatment and peer-to-peer communities into real life. In Fellowship House, we provide a design for living that focuses on education and service. We have strong relationships with the 12 universities and vocational schools in the area and ensure that our fellows pursue their personal goals while entering sobriety. We also stress independence and responsibility, making sure each individual is financially solid and self, and helping to make their community a better place. As a treatment center, Fellowship House offers both residential and outpatient treatment services to individuals and families affected by addiction and alcoholism. We're a DDAP licensed provider of general outpatient, intensive outpatient, and partial hospitalization programming, as well as a level of care assessments. If you want to find out more information about Fellowship House, please visit fellowshiphouses.com.
So 13 to 17 kind of wraps up. What does that look like, becoming 18? What's going on then?
Yeah, I was a senior in high school. I had gotten a full ride to Wilmington for golf, and this guy was, the coach there was kind of looking at me for a while. And so I decided to go there after high school. And, you know, I wanted to be a lawyer. I wanted to be a defense attorney, and took criminal justice there. And
trust me, that won't interrupt your golf game.
It did. Yeah. Right. Well, that's why I quit, because I found out how much work it actually took. And I'm like, fuck that.
You could talk to any criminal lawyer. He'd rather be a golfer.
Yeah. Well, that's so during that, like, I went there for 2 seconds, but during that time I found out there was a golf school, in Myrtle Beach, and my eyes lit up. And one of my mentors, he was a golf pro, at the club I grew up at. I just kind of had it like a aha moment. I was just like, that's what I want to do. And, you know, so I kind of called up my dad, and I don't think he was too thrilled that I wanted to, you know, pack my bags and go to Myrtle Beach. But, that's what I did. And it was a 2-year program. You got your associate's degree in business, and, believe it or not, I barely passed. I had to sit next to an accounting major to pass the final, to pass and graduate. But that was a crazy time frame too for me. I think, you know, that's kind of when I was introduced to, you know, strippers, and you know, I was starting to do a little bit more, you know, coke and all that stuff while I was down there. And it was a good time, but it was a real shitty time too. I turned 21 years old down there, and that was a shit show in itself.
And how are you financing all this?
My dad was kind of fitting the bill for everything. We found this apartment near my school, and, you know, he was helping me out financially. He kind of gave me a budget, and like, this is what you have for rent and everything else. And, you know, I would do some work at some golf courses, like on the side, like under the table stuff. But he was helping me out financially, and which, you know, looking back on it now, really, you know, it hurt me, you know, but he didn't know anything that was going on, really, you know.
Did anybody?
No.
How about you? How did you consider it? Did you feel, this is something, if exposed, the rate and the amount that you're partying, do you think someone would be concerned if they knew the whole picture?
I think so. Yeah.
Did you think that way then? Like, this is something to hide? Okay.
No, I don't think I really care. Well, and the thing, and my dad did know I went to like a couple strip clubs because he would see some ATM transactions that I made at to get money out at. So I'm like, yeah, I went there last night, but I don't think he knew the extent of it because I would bring, you know, four or five of them back to my apartment with a couple of my friends and, you know, just have a good time.
Thanks, Dad.
Yeah, right. It's horrible looking back on it now, you know, but I had gotten a gun pulled out on me on my 21st birthday by a cab driver, just being an asshole. But
you drew down on you?
Yeah. I didn't do anything wrong. If anything, I overtipped the guy too, and he still did it.
What did he feel was such a threat that he was ready to blast you?
He was trying to, he was a cab driver, and they would post up at strip clubs and when for, and this one was, they didn't close till like 5 a.m., but he picked me up, and I live like 5 minutes down the road, and this guy was like going completely the opposite way, and I kind of called him out on it, and again, acting like a idiot, and the cab ride that should have been like 10 bucks turned out to be like, I don't know, $30 or something like that.
Yeah, he's hosing you.
I made a big fuss about it, and I just threw like, I don't know, like 60 bucks cash at him or something like that. And I said, go fuck yourself. And he got out and like
flashed a piece.
Yeah, flashed it.
You flash your piece out on the lane, man. I snatch it from you.
Yeah. He showed it to me. He pulled up his shirt and then he pulled it out and pulled it at my forehead.
Oh, man.
And then I'm acting like this tough guy. Like, oh, yeah, pull the trigger.
Now, did you ever see this cab driver again?
No. Well, the funny thing was, I didn't like, there was the neighbors saw it. It was at like, you know, 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. So people are going to work.
Yeah.
I'm just coming in.
You're getting executed by a cab driver.
Yeah. So people had saw it, but and cops came and I had to fill out a report and everything.
Man, that's wild. How long ago was that? Because it just in height of today being April, 2023, I've read five or six stories in the last week of just extremely scared people shooting other people of mistaken door knocks, getting into the wrong car, two cheerleaders shot, one killed. This was like 2 days ago. And I'm seeing this rev up on the media, like in Florida. I don't know if you're paying attention to it. It just seems relevant of how quickly people are not only show a gun of the, I mean, these are just people opening fire. The guy down in, was it Ohio? Kid knocked on the wrong door looking for his brother. He just shot him. Mm. Just opened the door and shot him.
What do you think? I mean, that's more like, what do you think about that as far
fear.
As?
It's someone sitting. You know, maybe they have racist tendencies for whatever reasons, their culture, their limited background, education, socioeconomics, where you're raised, what year you're born, who your family is. This kind of creates what's in your mind. Mm. So you can't escape it. Like these elements are and variables are chosen for you.
Yeah.
It's can you break free from them so you're not running through life fucking terrified all the time.
Right.
So now this guy's in his like 60s. This is how I'm kind of perceiving it. He's sitting there just fucking getting hammered by the news all day.
Yeah.
That, you know, immigrants are raiding in at untold numbers. Eventually they're going to come to his door and take his soup and throw him out of his house. I don't know. Whatever, you know, madness reigns in someone's head.
Yeah.
From your fears. So it's not just what the news is saying. It's what you project the world's going to be.
Yeah.
Like it's you completing the news story. I know how it ends.
Yeah.
Like it's going to be a war. It's going to be a race war.
Yeah.
Like this, you know, these are the fucking minds just being poisoned. So we could watch the same news product and one guy's getting reinforced with like racist agendas and being scared. Now, if there's a black kid on my porch ringing his bell, there's only one reason why he could be there.
Right.
He's going to rob me and he's in a gang.
Yeah. Well, you know what?
Black Lives Matter is now at my house to solicit a fight.
See, I read that. Yeah. It's crazy because it's funny now because I heard something like, or I saw a video the other day about like ringing the doorbell like now versus like back in the 90s.
Back in the 90s. The comedian?
But back in the 90s, like, you were excited when the doorbell rang. Like, you were like, you know, it's one of your friends, or, but now it's like, you turn off all the lights, you hide. You know? It's like crazy.
Phone.
Yeah.
Yeah. In-person contact. I think it takes more energy from people to be present for, like, in-person social engagements.
Mm-hmm.
It became real common. I even like 10 years ago, I'd be hanging with friends. We could be texting and half paying attention to each other. You know, if you did that 10 years prior to that, it would be really rude. Mm-hmm. I remember when Nextel would have that two-way beep, beep, beep in restaurants, people would be offended. Then it became normal. Then, you know, it's, I think there's a pushback now. When I'm with my wife or we're with people, they get all of our attention.
Mm-hmm.
I think people get tired of that. It's just, it takes so much.
Yeah.
Especially it's crazy. After the last 3 years, some of the isolation from COVID, you get comfortable not being around people.
Yeah. I mean, it's bad. I mean, Carly and I were talking about it because she had gotten rid of her like social media and all that. And I don't have any social media anymore.
Carly is our master clinician at Fellowship House.
Yeah, she's okay. but like, I do have TikTok, which is still like, ugh. I hate that I like it so much. But
Carly purged herself of all of that.
Yeah, and you know, even me being on Facebook and Instagram, like I've seen like a mental change in as far as like, I don't care about like what. It's so funny to me now, like looking back on, like I have to post this picture of like, look at me at on fucking, you know, Greece. Like, why do I feel the need to share that with everyone?
You know? I have a problem. The podcast was a way to combat it. Like it could meet the needs of like how I like. It was heard it like
gunshot there.
Explosion.
Uh-oh.
Sorry, people, there's explosions in Greenwich. Speaking of gunfire, they're here. They're now shooting at us.
They're at the doorbell.
Yeah. It's everywhere now. Stories, news, my house, we're shooting. Well, I don't know. That was my way to combat it because, it has a really strong effect on me, now, that I could feel it. It lingers for days. I feel like almost disassociation, peeling away from the phone, Instagram, Facebook. I've erased the apps from my phone and I go on maybe 3 times a week to post the podcast. But even if I leave it linger that day, I'll be tracking things, looking for things, or I'll be scrolling on I don't have TikTok, but I do the reels on Instagram.
Yeah, same thing.
They're awesome. It's really bad because it's nothing I need to be giving my time to.
No.
I have a lot to do.
Yeah.
And a lot of people need my attention.
Yeah.
And I could be somewhere for 15 minutes. I could be looking in the morning before I could be meditating or doing something to start my day, go down to the gym. And I could 15 minutes just gone and I'm watching weird shit.
Yeah.
Just weird stuff, thinking it's hilarious, but I'm like, what am I doing? Like this, I didn't make a willful decision or plan that to be part of my day. It's just frightening to think the commodity is my attention and I just sold it to someone. Right. I just gave it to them. They're exploiting my frontal lobe is gone. That's the real fear for me, at the sense of AI rising up and running these things. If it had its own goals, we wouldn't even know you're being spun out. I'm not even saying it has to be a robot. We're not even talking about a manifestation of some AI in a singular machine. Just now, it influences us tremendously. It rewards lies. It's already trained to manipulate humans and scare them and spread false information. It just frightens me. The three things you shouldn't have done with super systems like that, like Instagram and all these models and the rise of AI, is teach it about human psychology or cognition or emotion. it knows how to manipulate humans. Mm-hmm. Like, that was one thing you should never do to AI. They said that in the 60s. The second thing is put it online.
Right.
And now it's pervasively could get into anything if it's going to be a super intelligence. And super intelligence is, it's unhuman. It would be alien yeah. to our own cognition. And then the third thing is never teach it psychology. Don't put it online and never teach it and train it in code, writing code. Mm-hmm. Now, this is what would make it self-generating. I know we went off on a tangent here and I did on my last podcast, but it's
scary.
It's the news that has my full attention because I love existential crisis.
Yeah.
But this one's really unique and some people are really scared. Some people are really happy and I've been trying to listen
to,
where are the guardrails on this? But it's hard to imagine AI being great. I believe them. If they're great, it's got guardrails and it doesn't become conscious. What I don't believe is if it is conscious and you don't align it, right? We're all dead. Yeah. Like there's no escape from it. Like we are just prey to whatever its will is. Mm-hmm. I've just spent 15 minutes every morning, like any morning I could be victim to my own phone, mm-hmm. my own attention. And I didn't make a decision to do that. Mm-hmm. It's weird.
Yeah. It's bad. It's horrible.
Well, let's get back to your life story. Now that AI has taken in.
It is AI.
But, right. When did your addiction start to jeopardize what you're really good at and what you really enjoy is golf and you're a pro. And how did you lose that? How does one lose that because of an addiction? And how do you realize what's happening to you?
I don't know. I mean, I think when I turned 21 and I had gotten my first pro job is when it kind of really took a downfall. But as far as like the game itself, that's a love that I will always have. And I always did because that was my escape of, you know, everything, you know, it was kind of like my drug in a way. But I had gotten my first pro job when I was 21, and you know, I think that kind of shot my ego through the roof when all my friends were, you know, still in school, and I had a golf pro job making, I don't know, it was like 30, 35 grand a year, and I thought it was $1 million.
Yeah, man, that's a real shot of pride, yeah. Identity, a payout from mm-hmm. all the time spent with golf. Now you're pro.
Yeah. But I had gotten 2 DUIs during that time, like back to back, like within a month. And I would show up late all the time. And that job probably lasted, I don't know, like 6 to 8 months. And I got fired. But I quickly found another one. And it was just kind of the same pattern throughout my whole career. And, you know, just kind of went, I bounced around, and then there was this one job opportunity that opened up in Florida. And prior to that, that's when Novak lived with me and my brother and my mom. And my brother had gotten, me and him got into a very big argument. And it's crazy looking back at it now. Like I was going to work and he was coming in from a bender, and him and I got in this big argument, and he went to rehab that day and stayed sober ever since then. And
did you have any definition in your mind of what recovery was, or had friends or people disappear in your life that went to treatment prior to your brother?
I mean, Novak went before him, but I knew a couple of my friends, but I didn't really
have a working idea what recovery was.
I had no idea what AA was.
Let alone
no
definition of addiction.
No, not at all. I didn't think I had a problem whatsoever at that point. It took me a very long time to kind of realize that. But, you know, I was taking money from my mom and I didn't want to face it. And she caught me. I didn't want to face that conversation. Ugh. So that was like kind of a move for me to kind of go down to Florida and escape everyone. including my family members. And we were talking about that the other day.
Yeah.
Where I kind of cut off communication with everyone. It would kind of be spurts here and there, like, you know, with my dad, but, you know, it sucked because my mom would send me, like, you know, she would have people come over that I knew in Florida that, and she also knew, and they would deliver me birthday cakes that my mom would purchase. And, you know, I never once did I shoot her a text to say thank you or anything, because I still felt so guilty and shameful of, like, what I did.
It is guilt and shame. Let me, if you don't mind, if I could pry a little in the sense, you said your ego exploded when you got the position as your first golf pro position. You get a salary, young guy. Most people, it could be pride. It won't be just, say, an ego, but ego is distinct. It's this idea of this persona, this mask that I'm creating, this manufactured identity. And for some people that have trauma and addiction, the line is really blurry of where this true sense of self or an authenticity of self is versus the ego we manufacture. And I can relate to this profoundly because I feel like I designed an ego before I had a personality just because of circumstances that you can't control of what you're raised up. An ego rises up to defend a person from a reality that's just too painful, like this personality. So do you think some of this could have been the confrontation of now being just what could be called a thief, not an addict? There's, you took money. That's just too painful for someone to say, no, this is not how I think of myself, because I don't think of you as a thief. But addiction can make us justify all these strange patterns that we would always find immoral to do. But we'll never look at it as that as we're doing it. And do you think isolating yourself for that period down in Florida was that was just too painful to come to terms? If you admitted to that, you're admitting to a serious problem.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, I think so. I think that was, yeah. I mean, and that's the thing too, where it's just like when I was doing that, like my parents didn't raise me like that either, where it's just like, I didn't really know, well, I didn't want to know the extent of like what problem I had. I didn't want to hear it. But yeah, I didn't want to face reality. And the funny thing, it's actually fun. I was thinking about this the other day where I lived with someone in Florida and he didn't charge me rent, but he lived with his fiance and, he was in the program too. I had no idea what the fuck AA was. And I just knew he was gone for a while when I first started this job and he came back and because he was in rehab. But yeah, he said he was in the program, but, and all this stuff, I'm like, oh, good for you. And, it's funny. It's not funny, but like, you know, we were at the bar one day and he was there and with some of our work friends and we were doing coke and he decided to do some blow with us and he relapsed that. And I didn't know the extent. I'm like, oh yeah. As long as without a
drink. I've only known a couple people to do that and they're dangerous.
Yeah. But
it's anyone who just,
like, I didn't last long.
But the guy that's like, yeah, like he didn't prime himself with like four beers or a scotch. Just bumping lines of coke without a drink in your hand. I don't know. I keep my eye on that guy my entire drinking career. The guy who's doing cocaine without having a few drinks, I'm watching him because he's going to be a problem that night.
Oh, he didn't. Well, he didn't. He was perfectly fine. And it's crazy because granted, it only lasted maybe 2 months and then he started drinking again. But I didn't know like the extent of it. I'm like, oh, yeah, dude, if you just do coke, like that's fine. Like, just don't drink alcohol. That was your problem, right? Like, yeah. I was so oblivious to any of that.
Midnight advice. Do it like Freud. Just do it out of the intellectual interest of cocaine.
Listen to me. I've only had about an eighth of Jameson and an eight ball in my system at this point. But
how does that journey down to Florida end?
I had found a job in North Carolina and that was like the only job I left on good terms with. They actually offered me more money to stay. And I was like, you can offer me $100,000. I probably wouldn't stay, but, I've always wanted to end up in North Carolina, and ended up working down there, and that was short lived too. I kind of quickly, you know, I kind of starting to drink it. I was drinking, I was getting prostitutes. I would, you know, I graduated to crack, you know, a while back, but,
did that expedite things pretty quickly?
Oh yeah, it was bad. And I was talking about this the other day too, where, you know, I was getting paid bi-weekly, and I hated it when I wasn't sober, just because like I would spend that entire paycheck and then
3 days, 2 days.
No, not yet. Overnight.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have money for
13
2 weeks.
Days. Yeah. Yeah,
so like, yeah. And that killed me, but, and
how about cigarettes? Did you smoke cigarettes?
Oh yeah.
So how you get into a pack? Like that's,
I would have people from work just buy me. I was like, I'll get you.
Yeah. On average, if you could smoke all that you regularly smoke, is it 20 cigarettes a day?
No, I actually don't smoke a pack a day. I probably smoke, I don't know, 10, 15 a day.
You know, cigarettes are designed like by dosage, length, and, and by the pack to be 20 cigarettes a day. Because withdrawal starts immediately after you put it out, and full withdrawal would be an hour.
Oh, great.
After you have extinguished a cigarette. So on average, the whole design and metric of 20 cigarettes is to make sure all smokers would want to, like,
could
smoke a cigarette every hour, yeah. If not more.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that makes sense.
So you guys, 13 days to figure out how to get, you know, 1300 smokes.
Like, oh, it sucked, man. I got kicked out. I was living with a buddy of mine who worked at a different course. He was on the grounds crew at another course, but I couldn't stick up with rent. I think it was only like, you know, $600 or $800 I had to pay, but I couldn't afford a McDouble, you know? So I lived out of my car for about 6 months, and, you know, thankfully I had, you know, I worked at a golf course where they had locker rooms and showers. So I would shower there.
In the 6 months, was it, what seasons? Is it spring, summer? Was it?
It was, I think, fall. And it sucked because I would have to kind of put the heat on and turn off my car. And sometimes I wouldn't turn off my car. I would forget.
When did you get used to sleeping in your car to the fact it wasn't painful every night?
I don't think I ever got used to it.
So, man, it was fucking tough.
Because like even then I couldn't.
Did anyone know you were living in the car? Were you hiding this from the majority of the people that were in your like circle in North Carolina? Were you hiding?
No one knew. As far as people in North Carolina, I would tell them I was staying at a hotel.
Yeah.
There was a couple of times where I did ask like the head pro if I could stay with him, and he offered. He was like, you could stay with me until you find a place. And I just, my pride was, I didn't want to do that.
You might fuck it up too.
Right. Cause I'm walking in at 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, after, you know, doing drugs all night.
Man. Right. That's intense to walk around. That's fear. That's just total fear, shame. Anxiety? Is anxiety out of control by then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I couldn't. The Walmart parking lot was really where I stayed. And there was McDonald's right there. So I would kind of scrape up. I would literally scrape up, you know, like, you know, quarters and stuff to try to get a McChicken or whatever. But yeah, for those 2 weeks where I didn't get paid, it sucked.
Did you have a cell phone?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When the loneliness would drive in and you know, I have a lot of friends and people I've known really well that have ended up homeless in various ways, from a car to not having a place to live, going house to house, to straight to the streets of Kensington. There's something that's just brutal. It's loneliness, and it will arise, you know, until you totally lose a sense of yourself. It'll rise every day.
Mm-hmm.
When would that happen to you? Would it be in that parking lot? Would you be tempted and compelled to just call someone and say, this got to end? Like what restrained you from calling home?
I think it was just like, just fear of not having that conversation. But I eventually did, you know, I eventually did call my mom and, I told my work that I needed some time. I don't know how long that's going to be. It could be forever. I don't know, but I just wanted to go home and sleep in a fucking bed. And, So yeah, I did eventually move back up here, and I haven't seen my mom in, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years or something like that. And so that was a very emotional moment, you know, especially for her. But I think really where the depression hit was, you know, I had gotten a job after that too, and but I had gotten fired from that job too from stealing money from there. But I had something what they call that clinical depression where I literally stayed in my room for probably 6 months, maybe a little bit more.
Yeah.
I wouldn't get up. The only time I would get up was to get food, and yeah. I would literally pee out the fucking window because I was too afraid to face anybody.
That's crippling.
You know, I lived with my brother, who was sober and he was in the program, and, you know, my mom was there, but, you know, she would come in and check on me every now and again. But I did not want to face anybody because I didn't know. I thought my life was done because I had just broken up with a girlfriend. I lost my job, my dream job that I had. Mm-hmm. I was facing a third DUI at the time. And, you know, I have this, like, stigma that I'm a thief because I stole yeah. money from a club that, you know, to feed my addiction, really. But I didn't know where to go from there. I was so fucking lost. And I, to the point, like, my lawyer kept on, like, continuing the court date until I went to treatment. And, you know, I was still going. I would go out in the middle of the night to go on a little bit of a binge. You know, my mom would give me a couple $100, but I would stay out for 3 days at a time. And,
well, that sucks. They're not fun to yeah. come back to that after 3 days no. to crawl back into your mom's house.
Yeah, it was bad. And, you know, I met someone else on this dating app, and, in a way she saved my life in a way. Because I attempted suicide. I, kind of had enough. I had stole from the girl I was talking to, and, I wrote a whole bunch of letters on paper towels with a Sharpie, and the place I was at, I had a whole bunch of, there was a whole bunch of Advil there, so I just started, like, chewing them. It's corny. It's going to sound corny, but, like,
it's desperation.
Yeah, but she sent me this, like, our song that we used to listen to, like, while I was chewing the fucking pills, and I just spit them out right away when she sent it to me. And, but that was just the moment where I just kind of gave up, and I was surrounded by a whole bunch of cops, and, I had a warrant out for my arrest from stealing from my job, which I had no idea I had. And this cop was like, you know, this cop, by the way, like he's saying that he knows you. I'm like, I don't know anybody over there. I don't know who you're talking about. But this cop that used to come by the club that I worked at, him and I became pretty good friends, and he's the one that picked me up.
Oh, man. I'm
like, great. Like, this is the last person I want to see right now. But he gave me a hug and just said, you know, I want to see you here again, you know. But so I had to go to treatment the day after that. But, yeah.
Well, what brings you to Scranton?
Yeah, Scranton. I relapsed, but going to I had a scare at, you know, I was kind of held hostage in a way, and you know, the first go around it took me a while to kind of get into treatment, but this one I had, you know, I was kind of like, all right, I need to do it, but after what I just went through, and I going through that whole stage, it's hard to even believe that I, you know, kind of went through something like that. It's weird to say even now, but, you know, I was trying to, you know, really control things my first go around. I kind of thought I knew it all. I was a house manager at one point, and, but coming here, it was really weird how I ended up here. I went to Clearbrook in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
I was there for 20 days. I came up to, they tried to send me to Langhorne, which is a PHP for Banyan. And I was like, no, I don't want to go there. I want to go to Clearbrook down there. I thought they did PHP there too, and they didn't. But they're like, oh, well, we found this place called Mountain's Edge. It's like pretty new. It's so I'm like, all right, fuck it. I'll do that.
It's by Elks Mountain here. So at this point, just like if someone was listening, like your continuum of care here, you get detoxed. You got 28, 30 days in inpatient treatment. Mm-hmm. And from there, you want to go for further treatment, mm-hmm. and that could be up to more 90 days, what you're calling a PHP, partial hospitalization program.
Yeah, and I didn't know it was 90 days. I thought it was 30 days, but I went up to my counselor, and she was like, I'm like, how long is the stay here? Like 30? She's like, well, we recommend 90. I'm like, I'll do 90.
Yeah.
So it was really, that's what it was really different this time. I was really...
willing to do anything to get help.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I did the 90 there, and, I experienced something, one of my best friends died while I was in treatment there, and that kind of killed me. And, cause he had came in and visited me like, a couple weeks prior to his death. And, weeks leading into it, I was on the phone with him every day trying to get him to actually come up to Mountain's Edge. Cause, there was a guy there that like has been to like 37 treatments, and he said, this is like by far the best place I've ever been to. And it truly is. I mean, as much as I hate to give Joe Kane a lot of credit here, but that whole staff there, it really changed my life.
Joe Kane's the clinical director of Mountain's Edge.
Yeah. The groups that they run there, it's something short of amazing. It's really intimate, and it's something that it's really hard to explain. But
he's one of the best clinicians.
It's incredible.
I've ever met.
Yeah. It's crazy. And it's funny to see hear people like, oh, I fucking hate him. I'm like, well, it's probably for a reason. But
hate requires passion. So there's passion involved in there too.
It's just he calls people out and they're bullshit, and people just don't like that. And going through that, I mean, it was really they let me go to the funeral for my best friend, and I think that whole time, like that funeral really hurt, like it seared into my brain.
Yeah.
Cause I had my mom sitting next to me. And when the priest gave my mom or his mom the ashes, is like, my mom kept on saying like, don't do this to me. Don't do this to me.
Did you feel sober there? Like what was your feeling there that would be different from not being sober, just being dry? Because you went there with full intentions to grieve and in pain, but how would you describe feeling sober at that moment, Matt? Like, what does that mean there? Even though you're sad and in grief, did you feel vulnerable to drinking or relapsing?
No, I didn't. It's funny because after the funeral, I went to the, they had a gathering after where they all drink, and it was weird just looking at people and like, they're all drinking and, I like saw it from like a different perspective. Like, I'm like, man, that's what I would drink myself to death right now. Like this was 5 months ago,
Sure.
Because like, but it was like that just moment of clarity of like, they're doing that to numb the pain that they're currently in. And unfortunately I don't get to have any of those. Yeah. I get to feel it. Which I became like grateful to kind of feel that now in a way, just to feel feelings, whether that's happiness, sadness, anger, I'm kind of grateful to and able to like go through those feelings and really experience them all, cause I haven't been really used to doing that for, like a decade,
So how would you describe, the last 3 months of really getting your sea legs in recovery? Because how long are you sober now?
Almost 11 months.
Almost a year is coming up soon.
Yeah.
And it took a year of full treatment. There's not much you haven't done towards your recovery. Is the PHP afterward, you went to kind of still an intensive outpatient program, live in a recovery house. And that's when I got to meet you and, I've known you now since September.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny cause I think I've told you this, but I mean, I've heard you speak at a meeting and, you know, I kind of always had, you know, I was like, I really like to ask them to be my sponsor. And then like, I didn't see you at some of the meetings. And then I saw you at Willow House. And I was like, get the fuck out of here. This is like a, you know, fucking perfect moment.
There's that psycho.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been fucking looking for you. But that, yeah, I mean, the transit, I had no intention of staying in Scranton at all. I had zero, until about like 2 weeks of my discharge at Mountain's Edge. And then, one of my good friends, DJ, you know, he went there. We talked to Larry and, I was like, all right, well, I'll try it out. You know, I'm not going to stay there long probably, but I'll give it a shot. Might as well. But it's changed a lot, you know, since I first got in there.
Yeah.
But, I think it's all positives in a way, but it,
there'll be a lot more changes soon.
I can't wait.
You're patient zero, man. Golf pro to patient zero. That'll be the name of this. Right.
But, no, it's been, it's funny because every sober house I've only been to two, but like every one, they've been like brand new. So like been in like,
you've only been in brand new sober houses.
Yeah.
Wow.
And they're all like, they all need help and they all, which is good, you know, but you know, it's just, at Novak House, it was more like they had one house and then they started getting more. And then,
That was at a house. They didn't have outpatient services per se right there. It was more peer to peer 12 step.
Oh yes. And no, I mean, Brandon was part of, Banyan. So,
oh, that's right.
He wanted us to do IOP for Banyan, but it was all on Zoom. So you didn't have to. You could have went somewhere offsite if you wanted to, but he pushed people, and most people did, which was cool because we kind of all did it at a house, as a house. And but it was a 90-day thing, and
that's a good way to run a recovery house. What, mm-hmm. like, why be a recovery house? You're just an apartment building. If you're not initiating the tenants to be in some level of care, outpatient, IOP. I mean, what's the standard then? Like this is a place to get better, get more therapeutic measures to help you outside of peer to peer. I agree that everyone in a recovery house should be in a level of care.
Oh yeah, for sure. And the IOP for Banyan, I hated it.
Yeah.
I just didn't think the level of care was that good, but I think, it's really cool what you guys are doing just as far as like, you know, cause most sober houses do require you to do IOP and, but they're all off site, you know? Yeah. So this one, you get to walk downstairs and you're in IOP.
Go time.
Yeah. Which is cool. And, I think the groups are good and they're more, you were talking about it, it was like a couple of weeks ago, but like, as far as like the shares that people are having now in those groups, you know, I mean, they're younger kids and they're very, you know,
intimate.
Yeah.
Very safe. I am surprised at how people have responded to, not only the groups, some of the lectures of how we position what addiction is, the trauma based and informed ideas of addiction, and the meditation, Vipassana, that we practiced. I couldn't believe, you know, some people may not like it, but the people that have, I was just surprised by it. Because it's usually an act, for me, it was an act of desperation to make it part of my lifestyle. But I think some people really gelled with it.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's funny because I've been to like maybe two meditation groups this whole time.
Yeah, you only go to this.
The first one. I only go to your group, Joe.
Yeah.
But
you missed a good meditation last week. Were you there for the comet? My don't look up meditation?
No.
It was more of a visualization. Carly and I are trying to flush it out into, it's a good tool to see what is at the surface of the top of mind of your desires. 17 days left on Earth. And we explore some means of what you would do, even in early recovery, given the chance to be with loved ones. Who wouldn't be there, given that wouldn't forgive you for whatever, wherever your broken relationships are? would you relapse under this blight and nihilism that like we're all getting destroyed anyways? Mm-hmm. Would you be driven to get laid? Revenge. Some people wanted to get revenge. It was crazy. And then on day 17, we said it was 18 days and the comet hits. Day 17, the comet misses. And, you know, now who are you? Like, if you this total nihilistic approach to the end, we have to stand in judgment of ourselves of what was priority. Who did we become under this crisis? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you really have to paint the visualization. And we took our time for an hour to do it and breathing. And this group has been together for a while now. So it wasn't just a cold audience. There was like 9 of us. It was wild what some of these answers were.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, especially for the fathers in the room.
Yeah.
Of where they are. And what you target then is where your men's need to be.
Yeah.
And why would you need, there's always a fucking comet coming for us. If you're an alcoholic or a drug addict or have substance use disorder, your fears are comets. You manufacture such tremendous fears and shame that you'll relapse at any given moment with this unbridled brain.
Yeah.
So first off, the comet didn't kill us. So we always have this fake comet that's going to kill and ruin our lives and our world. But in that time, what did you abandon and what can't you fix or what did you run from? This is where your recovery should be focused on.
Yeah.
These are the relationships that can heal. And in doing so, you have recovery.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of how you go through the steps too, in a way. Yeah. Yeah, where you have those 10 big ones and, you know, it's, you know, going through that, and it's cool how, you know, you kind of perceive that. And, but yeah, mainly we make a mountain out of a molehill 100% of the time, really.
Well, at that point, the other reason that worked, I put these tubes up the lining of the wall, and I've been able to just fill half the room with nitrous. Let us begin, gentlemen. but I am glad to have met you. We're coming up at an hour, and I'm going to have you back on. But the reason I wanted to have you on, getting to know you the last couple months and seeing recovery just transform your life, your relationships, you making hard decisions, and experiencing grief and loss and love all within 11 months and not having to drink and realizing, you know, drugs and alcohol weren't your problem. They were a failed solution. It's so hard to let go of something that almost works, drugs and alcohol.
Yeah.
And to see you see that, you know, come to be a total fact in your life here and what you've done for our house and how you've inspired people there. I'm grateful. I'm glad you came on.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure. It's been a shitty year and it's been a great year, but,
that's what theater is. It's the two masks. You gotta.
Yeah.
How about that? I forget to use sound effects, but
I love
all
it.
Right, man.
Well, thank you, Joseph.
I'd like to thank you for listening to another episode of All Better. You can find us on allbetter.fm or listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and Alexa. Special thanks to our producer, John Edwards, and engineering company 570 Drone. Please like or subscribe to us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And if you're not on social media, you're awesome. Looking forward to seeing you again. And remember, just because you're sober doesn't mean you're right.
Hi, this is Joe Van Wee, your host of All Better. I had a few announcements. If you're interested in subscriber content, which we're about to launch, this would be step workshops, cognitive behavioral therapy tools, and mindfulness practices that are approachable and can be very useful in reducing anxiety, rumination, and depression. Please send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. And if you like the episodes that you've been hearing very much, please stop by Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and a small review. This helps us stay relevant in the field of content and helping people and their families with substance use disorder. Thank you.